I do have a plan, but I would also like to ask what you would like to get out of this seminar. What do you hope to learn? And I just heard. Would you like a chair, sir? There's some chairs in the back. Do you need a chair? If you could make way for this gentleman so he could get a chair in the back, please. If you can get a chair. Okay, so I'd like to ask if there's something that you would particularly like to learn, or something you're particularly hoping to get out of this seminar, then I can sort of make sure that we cover those areas. Yes, sir.
How to bring up your interest.
Yeah, okay. Well, this is going to focus specifically on Southerner, how for parents to have good Southerner and engage their children in Southerner. I'm going to concentrate on that area. This morning I went over a very general thing, sort of general principles. Yes?
I'm interested to know what happens if the child is growing up in an environment where maybe there's one person who's Krishna conscious or aware of Krishna consciousness. The child is surrounded by family, friends, and other kids who are not. So what happens when the child interacts with non-Krishna consciousness?
So is your question exactly what happens? Because I don't know if everyone heard her. She was saying that what happens if the child is in an environment where one person in their life is Krishna conscious and everyone else who's surrounding them are not? Obviously what happens varies a lot from situation to situation. And sometimes the child becomes Krishna conscious and makes the whole family Krishna conscious, and you know, that depends. So I think your question is not so much what happens, because if we look at 20 different cases, we're going to find 20 different answers to that question. Are you asking more, if we're the one who's Krishna conscious, how do we help that child when everyone else around them is not? Is that more the question? Okay. Anything else that you'd like to cover in the... Yes?
Just that you're talking about books and stories. What kind of books they're learning to read books? How would you stop them from reading other stories?
Well, that's a little bit off the... It's kind of a whole other topic, so I'll just answer very briefly that we don't have enough Krishna conscious books for the children to only read that, first of all. Second of all, Prabhupada wanted our children to read some of the recognized classics. He didn't want our children to grow up as fools. I mean, Prabhupada himself quoted from Shakespeare. One morning walk, Prabhupada just told the story of the Merchant of Venice. That's all he did on a whole morning walk. Prabhupada would refer to the Iliad and the Odyssey. He'd refer to Aesop's fables. He expected the children to be educated. So you want to give them exposure to some stories from the outside that are, A, very important for educated people to know. They should have some, they should read something from Twain and Dickens and Shakespeare and people like that, according to Prabhupada's instructions. And also you want to give them exposure to some stories where the values and the culture are very supportive of Krishna consciousness. And there are many. I mean, we're not the only people in the world who worship God and who have some higher values. So there are certainly people who are writing books that are at least supportive. And what I found is that exposing children to those kind of books deepens their faith in Krishna consciousness. If they think that it's just our little group that believes some things and everyone else believes something else, that was much harder for them than if they saw that it's also, you know, the Christians, the Jews, the Muslims, they also accept many of the same things that we're accepting. So we have a form in the Vaikuntha children book, which is right now out of print, which I'm getting someone to type in little by little by little, for how to evaluate outside books, how to determine whether or not an outside book is suitable. And often that means you have to read it yourself first, but there are certainly many. Anything else? Especially things that people would like, that any of you would like to know within the context of sadhana, or that you're hoping to get out of this? Yes.
Stages in children's life, what is the action the parents should be taking at different stages of their life?
You know what? I'm going to make a note of that. So what to do at different stages. I think that's an important topic, and I should probably actually in the future add that to my plan for the seminar. Thank you. Mm-hmm. That's very important. Okay, something else that you'd like to get at, or something else that you're looking to learn? Yes.
What are the necessary steps that I should take so that my child will be more Krishna consciousness than more than myself?
More than yourself. Well, that was really covered this morning. What are your three most important things to do that to ensure that your child is going to take up the culture and the values of Krishna consciousness? So we'll go a little bit into that with specifics with sadhana and more than yourself, huh? Well, I don't know. At least as much as yourself. Yes.
If the child is inclined towards sport, should we encourage development along with friends, or how do we balance the state?
Okay, well, that's also something that's quite off the topic of sadhana, Prabhupada. Just this morning I was hearing him say, you know, no gambling also means no frivolous sports. And I once, when I was putting together my 20 children, I queried all of the leaders in ISKCON, please define frivolous sports. And nobody would even answer me. That's part of the null curriculum in ISKCON. We don't even try. I know one leader recently who tried to define a frivolous sport, and many people then criticized him. So we can't even figure out that for adults. What is a frivolous sport? Just frankly, okay, there's no consensus in ISKCON as to what constitutes a frivolous sport for an adult, what to speak of for a child. Now we know that Prabhupada did encourage the children to run and play, and he even taught some games that the children could play. So obviously we have to have, you know, a fit body and get good exercise, and children naturally want to run and play. You know, if you have a child who wants to become a world-class athlete, so that, I think it depends on the particular individual. That's really an individual thing. I don't think there's some sort of a formula or a rule for that. I mean, Prabhupada dealt with adults who were top athletes, and he never said, oh, to be my devotee, to be my disciple, you have to give up your sport. Like, say, Peter Burwash, for example. Never said that. Yes.
Apart from our sadhana, for our well-being of body, how much we should endure for physical exercise and same sports, that aspect.
Okay, well, that's also kind of off the main topic. How much should we endeavor for exercise? Krishna says one who's moderate in eating, sleeping, working, and recreation can mitigate all pains by practice of the yoga system. So Srila Prabhupada personally spent about an hour and a half every day getting a massage, and about another hour or so, altogether about two and a half hours every day he spent just on himself, on massage and walking, brisk walking, just simply for his health. So that should give you some indication. You know, and that's, again, going to vary from individual to individual. If somebody has a specific health problem that needs more time, you know, so that's, you got to keep your car working. Yes?
In the morning you just explained that, you know, how you work with children, you and your husband, you have been a mentor to your children. Now they are basically devotees and they're branching their practice and so on. That's one side of the coin. And you see, like, other senior Vaishnavas in the ISKCON, some of the children are not devotees, some of them are going for the various things. So how do we understand that?
Everybody has free will. Our business as parents is to give our children the very best opportunity. You can't, I mean, even Krishna has children that turn out bad. And of our own three children, they're at various levels of practice. Some are more strict than others. So that depends. I mean, first of all, we can't be at fault. We shouldn't be at fault. So if we've created a negative trigger between sadhana with our children, as we were talking about this morning with triggers, if we've been exposing them to the stories of the mundane world, if we have a television in our house where they're being constantly bombarded with mundane stories, we don't tell the Krishna conscious stories, we never develop a trusting relationship with them, then we're going to be accountable. But if we've done everything that we possibly can, it's up to them. Ultimately, they're free will beings, and they're going to decide whether or not or to what extent to take up Krishna consciousness. And we're in a society where they're surrounded by many influences. So what does Krishna say? You have a right to perform your prescribed duty, but you're not entitled to the fruits of action. Never consider yourself the cause of the results of your activities, and never be attached to not doing your duty. We are not in control. I mean, I'm not even in control of something that's material. I can't control whether or not the car that I drive is going to work. What to speak of a living being? A living being is not subject to my control. Isn't that correct? Right? I can't even control what's going to happen with my own body. I can get in an accident or so many things. So if one is very attached to the result, then one tries to control the children, and then you're going to probably end up creating negative triggers. So you do your very best. You do your very best. And then even if the child ends up going through some period of difficulty, even if the child becomes materialistic, if you set up a relationship of trust, something that Prabhupada told my father in 1974. Okay, wait a minute. I would like everybody please to move up half a meter. One, two, three, vote. Okay, that's cozy. Thank you. Don't worry, I'm not armed or anything. Thank you very much. One thing Prabhupada told my father in 1974, he said, I'm coming to the temple not to see Krishna, but to see my daughter and son-in-law. Is that okay? Am I allowed to come to the temple to see my family, just to see my family? And Prabhupada was, he was sitting like this. He was leaning back. You could see his right leg and foot. He was in a very relaxed, jolly mood. He said, yes. He said, they are loving Krishna. So I was thinking, I'm not loving Krishna. He said, chanting and dancing are symptoms of loving Krishna. So they are loving Krishna, and you are loving them, and two things that are equal to the same thing are equal to each other. So if you develop a tight relationship of friendship with your children, even if they become distracted, and after all, you know, the odds are really stacked against us. You don't have a school here. Many of you are not homeschooling. Your children are going to the outside schools. Even if you keep college users' generals out of your house, they'll run into him at other people's houses. You know who those are, right? Who's college users' generals?
TV.
Movies and the internet. Yeah. Okay, so even if you don't let them into your house, they'll probably be exposed to them if they're going to school. And even if you protect them till they're 18, then they'll be exposed at the university. I mean, I've seen really good kids. They got initiated, they were following, they were really pukka, and they lived at the university in the dorm. The kids I've seen who lived at home did all right, but living in the university in the dorm, and then they ended up getting into intoxication with success because that was what was going on all around them. Good kids, Indian kids, Western kids, good families, because of that association. So you do the best that you can. That's all anybody, thank you. That's all anybody can do. We're talking again about living beings with free will. But at least if they're attached to you, like Prabhupada said, they're attached to you, and if you're attached to Krishna, they'll continue to be benefited. Then you never know. You take the story of Ajamila. So Ajamila had a very good family. They raised him very nicely. He was a first-class Brahmana. You all know the story of Ajamila? Right? And then he got in trouble. He left his wife. He gave up his old parents. And his parents died. When his parents died, he was still a nonsense. They had to die brokenhearted that their son was a nonsense. And he went back and got it. Why? Because of his childhood training. Because of his childhood training. So there's no loss. There's no loss. If you give the children good training, there's no loss. Permanent asset. Also, if you don't train them in Krishna consciousness, if they do run into difficulty, what do they have to come back to? Now, if they don't even know what Krishna consciousness is, how can they even make a choice to accept it or reject it? They don't even know what it is. Okay, anything else you'd like to add to the seminar so far? We only had two questions in relationship to sadhana. Take just another 5 minutes. Yes?
about children whose parents have fallen down within ISKCON and have set a bad example, but then they are trying again?
The parents or the children?
The parents.
Well, if parents have difficulty, it depends a lot on how honest they are. One thing that really turns off children is hypocrisy. Oh, we still need some people to move up. There's some space here. If people here could move up a little bit, please. Again, everybody has to move up. It can't just be like just this whole group. Here, please move up like half a meter. So a lot of it depends on hypocrisy and integrity. So I don't know very many parents who are completely pure. And you need to be honest with your children, especially if they get to be teenagers. I mean, you can say, look, this is an area that we know we should follow and we're having difficulty in it, but we're trying. And in the purport to Bhagavad Gita 3.31, Prabhupada says that even if someone can't follow everything, if they don't envy the principle and they try without consideration of defeat or hopelessness, they'll eventually get to the perfect stage. So if there's something that the parents can't do, they should at least say to the children, you know, this is something that's good to do. We wish we could do it. We're trying to do it. We'd like to come to that platform. So they don't pretend to be doing something that they're not, and they don't criticize the principle. Do you understand what I'm saying? By criticizing the principle is, all those people who go to Mangalarti, they're all just hypocrites and fakers, and that's criticizing the principle. Okay, there was something else? Especially if you have something specifically you wanted to learn in relationship to sadhana. So I'm only hearing a couple of those. Yes, no?
It's not related to
sadhana. Okay. I mean, the others I've tried to answer right now, very quickly. But anything all that you'd like to cover in relationship to sadhana that I'll try to integrate? Yes, sir.
Thank you, Shamadaji. What if any person or a student, he was not in Krishna consciousness before, or he tried to become Krishna conscious, and his parents and relatives are not happy, so what?
Okay, so what do you do? Well, this is really what we'll discuss also, you know, a little bit, because there's not an easy answer, but we'll touch on that a little bit. So in other words, what do you do when there's obstacles, when you have family members who are in opposition, right? Okay. That's not the only obstacle, is it? Alright, anything else that anybody wants to cover in relation to sadhana? Yes?
Please also tell us how an unmarried person is going to get married and how things will go on.
That's actually something that I work with, but that's far beyond the boundary of this seminar. Okay? I have worked with the Grihastha Vision team for a long time. If you're really interested in that, I've got a computer program ready to go. We're just waiting for somebody willing to host it on the website and run it that will do internet matchmaking. So for the devotees. So if you know of anybody, worked on this for I don't know how many years. Oh my God, how many years? 6-7 years. Got all the programming done, everything. It's all ready to go. All the internet matchmaking sites right now are all profile sites. I hope you know what that means because I don't want to get into it. But we did a thing where the computer does the matchmaking and gives you possible, it's much more dignified. But I'm waiting for somebody to host it. So it's certainly an area that I'm very interested in. And if you want more information in general about support for entering the Grihastha Ashram, being in the Grihastha Ashram, I suggest you go to a site called VaishnavFamilyResources.org. VaishnavFamilyResources.org, and then you'll find out about courses specifically for people planning to enter the Grihastha Ashram, for people already in the Grihastha Ashram, programs for mentoring people before and early on entrance to the Grihastha Ashram. So, but I'm not giving that right now. That's another 2-3 hours. Okay. Let's look at the benefits of sadhana. So what are the benefits of sadhana? You can look at spiritual, material, anything. Benefits of sadhana.
Purification.
Purification. Peace. Okay? Discipline. Faith in God, did someone say? Did someone say faith in God? Self-control. Okay.
Spiritual strength.
Spiritual strength. Do you know that Prabhupada defines spiritual strength as sadhana and shraddha and shraddha, yeah. And sadhana and shraddha.
Happiness. Happiness.
Yes.
Stop us from falling down.
Stop us from falling down. Can you put that positively?
Character. Worshiping.
Well, that's more an activity than a benefit, worshipping.
Simple life.
Character.
Regulation.
Link to your culture.
Regulation.
Children will listen to you.
Regulation.
Your children will listen to you. That depends how you do your sadhana. Why don't we just say family bonding?
Krishna consciousness. It is klesha gni destroys the misery.
It's a shastra chakshu. What do we have? Happiness.
Cultivation of rational qualities.
I know I missed a couple that somebody said.
Self-realization.
Back to Godhead. Get a BTG subscription if you do your sadhana. Someone said something about association devotees or something? Did someone say that? Are you going to list like all the 26 qualities of the Vaishnava? And not only are you going to list all the 26 qualities, you're going to list them in Sanskrit, and I got to know what they are. Okay, I do know some. No, okay. My mic just died. Something else? Let's just say Vaishnava qualities. We already said Vaishnava qualities, okay? So that'll take all 26 of them. What?
Improve health.
Improve health. Okay. Yes, somebody else? Yes. Prasada.
We have some destination.
Hmm?
We can think of our destination.
We can fix our mind on our goals.
On goals.
Excellent.
Otherwise, we're heading nowhere.
Concentration.
Preach others.
What?
Preach others.
Preach to others. I missed one. What did we have here that I missed? Someone said something.
Concentration.
Concentration. See, I wasn't concentrating. That's improved. I don't know. All right. Thank you. Any others? Any other benefits? What?
Sinless.
Purification.
Purification of
person.
Book distribution.
Book distribution is a result of sadhana? Maybe. Help others. Inspiration to preach. That's a Vaishnava quality. We already had somebody try to list all of them in Sanskrit for me. They were testing my scholarship and my Sanskrit knowledge. I don't know. I didn't see you. My back was to you, so it's okay. What? A stress-free life. Internally, at least. This does not mean, folks, that Krishna goes in front of you with a steamroller making your path easy in life. Okay? That's not what it means. When Krishna says that samadhi is freedom from... This mic is really not very happy. What?
The battery's
compact. Okay, so in fact, if you follow Krishna's advice, just like the cowherd boys, Krishna told them go beg food from the brahmanas. Were they successful?
No.
So sometimes even if Krishna gives you a direct instruction, it may not work out. Nothing is always going to work out materially. So just read like Krishna says, you know, that's the way of begging. Sometimes you don't get things. So stress-free life, Krishna's saying, freedom from all material miseries is internal, that one is no longer identifying with the world. Yes?
We get Krishna.
You get Krishna! All right.
This
is another Vaishnava problem.
No meat eating.
Well, stand on the prasadam. If we're only eating prasadam, then we're only eating prasadam. Any other benefits we get from doing sadhana?
Attachment and detachment.
Attachment and detachment. Well, those are probably also.
Loving others.
Okay.
Your faith becomes stronger.
Ah, it does. It really does increase your faith. Yes.
Empowerment.
Actually, there's one place where Prabhupada says that if every single day you go to Mangalarjik and the whole program for 12 years, then everything you say will be perfect.
Twelve years ago.
I'm starting from today. Prabhupada also says that if we're steady in our sadhana, that Krishna will send all the facilities that we need for our service. He says all men, money, facilities, whatever we need. But that doesn't mean he'll necessarily do it in the next 2 minutes. Again, that's like we see with Srila Prabhupada. When he took up vanaprastha life, how long did he live without a fixed residence? Do you know? After Prabhupada became a vanaprastha? It was almost 5 years that Prabhupada lived without a fixed residence and basically in abject poverty. And then it was a few more years. Once Prabhupada got the room at Radhadamodar and he was printing his book, he often had to count his paisa to take a train to meet with a donor. And sometimes he didn't have enough paisa for the return journey. And then of course when Prabhupada came to America, it was about a year before he really had any sort of tangible result. And even then, I mean, it was just a few kind of scragglers. You follow? I mean, it was quite some time between the time that Prabhupada renounced his family life and the time that really the Hare Krishna movement was a full-on success. I mean, we're talking, at least 10 years. So certainly Krishna sent Prabhupada, you know, people and money and land and facility, but it wasn't exactly immediate.
His position was stolen, diabetes was stolen, not a thing was stolen.
That's unbelievable. I mean, that's really unbelievable. He had a handwritten Bhagavad Gita manuscript. Now, if I had handwritten a 1,000-page manuscript and it was stolen, I would probably quit. just frankly, I probably wouldn't start over again. And Prabhupada started over again. So anyway, the idea that we'll have a stress-free life, it's not necessarily that all the external stresses will be gone from your life. And the fact that Krishna will send everything to one who is strict in sadhana doesn't necessarily mean that he'll send it all exactly in the way you want or that he'll send it all immediately. So if we have that mentality, in fact, and we're thinking of Krishna as our order supplier, and we're thinking of him as some kind of a machine that if I just punch in the right buttons, you know, Krishna will give me what I want, and I'll be there. That's a desire to be a demigod. I want to worship Krishna from the Chela facility. All right. So now the list that I made of benefits was a little shorter and more general. I wrote that we get spiritual knowledge, that we learn morality and ethics, which I guess was sort of included here in Vaishnava qualities, that we get better physical health, that we have some connection to our community, and so you have connection to culture, association of devotees, social interaction. I mean, I know especially for myself, when I was a mother with very young children, I really liked coming to the temple because it was one of the few times that I could have some social interaction with other mothers. I really appreciated that. Attachment to Krishna, lifetime habits. I don't think anybody here mentioned habits. They did mention things like discipline and regulation. It also does form habits. Spiritual happiness, we mentioned that. And a sense of responsibility. So that was my little list of the benefits from sadhana. Okay. Now, sometimes what I do, which I'm not going to do today in the interest of time, but sometimes we actually look at each area of sadhana, which is like worship of the deities, japa, kirtan, prasadam, studying the shastra, and we think about how each of those areas relates to these different things, because not all of these things are fulfilled with all of the areas. Has he been reincarnated?
I
got another body. Okay, great. Live and well. All right. Thank you. We're back in business. Okay. Now, many years ago in ISKCON, we very much had the mentality that all sadhana should be performed at a temple. That was basically the move. And in those days, pretty much the parents, if they wanted to engage in sadhana with their children, would have to bring their children to a temple. And as I mentioned this morning, I saw that there were actually some problems with that in terms of negative triggers if the people at the temple were not child-friendly. So if you brought your children to the temple and the people at the temple were annoyed at the children, then it actually set up a difficult situation for the children psychologically and emotionally. But I also learned something else. When we were running the school in Detroit, we insisted that all of the children had to go to Mangalartik at the temple in order to attend school. So any day they didn't come to Mangalartik at the temple, they didn't attend school for that day. And later we moved to North Carolina and we started a school there. And we met with the whole community initially to ask about what kind of standards they wanted. And some of the parents said, well, we've been having the program at home for many, many years and we don't want to have to come to the temple. Would you be open to having a standard that allowed for a program at home? And I remember at the time thinking, well, this is really a compromise, but okay, if that's what's necessary, that's what we'll do. So we put that policy into effect, that either the children could have a morning program at the temple, or they could have one at home. Well, something very interesting happened. And that is, I saw that many people who were trained with the concept that you have to have your morning sadhana at the temple, once they were in a circumstance where going to the temple program was no longer feasible, they stopped their sadhana. They were actually being given an artificial standard that in order to have good sadhana, it has to be at the temple. And think about, what is the number of hours that the morning program goes on at the temple? How many hours is that? Almost five, really from 4:30 to 9:30. How many people can have a 5-hour sadhana program every morning? Not very many people. You know, if you're going to be going to a university, you're going to be going to a job, especially some jobs start early in the morning, 5 hours of sadhana in the morning, unless you're going to wake up at 1. Like Anandi Maharaj did that one time. You know that? The day after Ekadasi? He woke up a little too early to take his bath and he was arrested for getting up too early. I don't think that'll happen to you. The point is that for most people, 5 hours of sadhana is not practical. And for most people, going to the temple every morning is also not practical. And what I saw was that when we train the children that that's the standard, then they were more likely, when they grew up, not to have any sadhana at all. It was kind of surprising. because they thought that's the only way to do it, and that way is too hard. And whereas the children who had some mixture of sadhana at the temple and sadhana at home were much more likely to continue it because it was something they could continue. They saw it was something that they could do. They saw it was something practical. And what we suggested of the parents is that they have at least a basic program at home. So anybody can do a simple program at home. So I want to look, first of all, I think there's benefits of each. There's benefits to having programs at home, and there's benefits to having programs at the temple. So what are some benefits of having programs at home? Right now we're going to talk about the why, and then we're going to talk about the how. Time flexibility. Okay, at the temple, the program has to start at 4:30. At home, you know, if two of your kids are fighting or whatever, and it takes 5 minutes to settle that, and you can start at 4:35. Okay? You start at 5. Yes?
It becomes very natural, like having a meal at home or at
Zoom. Oh, very nice. So it becomes a natural part of the family, just like having a meal at home. It becomes an integral part of the family. What else are benefits from having sudden at home? Certainly saves time traveling.
Family bonding?
Definitely there's more family bonding. You can do it when all the children are present, right? You do it as a real family activity.
Not all members need to take it up immediately.
That's true. That's really true. And I'm very glad that you brought that up.
And that's what I found in my family, that both the kids did not take the same time. Each took their own time. Now both of them are.
Well, that's especially true if you're starting a sadhana program once your children are already a little older. And that's even true between husband and wife. So this deals somewhat with your question and your question. That, you know, what do you do if there's a situation where some family members are more interested than others? And having some sadhana at home, it makes it much easier for people to come in at their own time and in their own way. Going to the temple is much more of an all or nothing thing. Yes?
Srila Prabhupada was observing how his father was doing all the time puja, so it's inspiring, like inspiring.
Oh, okay. The Prabhupada was observing his father doing puja. And that when you're home, the program is much more in your hands. The children are seeing how much more you're involved and you're taking responsibility. At the temple, you can be often just more like an observer. Okay, so it's much more inspiring for the children. Some other benefits of having fun at home.
Social interaction also. We find that we tend to tell our friends that there is anyone coming to our house, look, my child can recite this particular poem. Come on, so why does the recite this book from Bhagavad Gita? It takes an opportunity to recite to others. So therefore, we're showing off our system.
Ah, okay. So that more social interaction, and I think if I understand you correctly, getting people to participate more. Yeah, I mean, one of the big advantages of sadhana at home, especially for the children, is that the children can participate on a deep level from a young age in ways that they're just not going to be allowed to do so at the temple. Now, some temples will allow more participation from children than others. Depends on the mood of the temple. But in many temples, they're not going to let the kids do much at all until they're, you know, 14, 15 years old. So at home, the children can offer artik or help with offering artik, like they can be leading the prayers. Again, in some temples, I've seen them let children lead kirtan, but that's rare. But generally, that's something that you can do at home.
Oh, yeah.
That's a very, very important thing. In fact, asking about how you can keep your children in Krishna consciousness, one of the main ways to do that is to give them responsibility. Spiritual responsibility in a nice way, remember about triggers, from as young of an age as possible. So, I mean, everybody wants to feel that they're doing something meaningful. And and what do children want to do more than anything else? They want to have fun, but what are they aiming to do? What's their goal? They want to be an adult. They want to be an adult. They want to grow up. That's their number one drive. is they want to be like the adults. They want to grow up. And this is one of the main reasons why people get involved in intoxication with sex. Those are the things we put out as adult activities, right? What do they call, you know, porno places? Adult shops? Or in America, there was a big thing with the tobacco companies that, oh, you're trying to get children to smoke. So they put out this advert that says, smoking is an adult activity. No better way to get kids to smoke than that. So kids naturally want to do something meaningful. They want to contribute. They want to be adults. So the more you give them meaningful ways to do that. And of course, in a natural society, the children were integrated into the family, into society from a very young age. It wasn't this thing that you just go to school and your only business is studying until you're 22 or 24 years old and then you can do something meaningful. This is a very modern idea. And this idea really pushes a division between the parents and the children. Can you all hear me in the back? And it also really pushes the children to engage in sinful activity. So one of the most wonderful things you can do for the children is train them in some kind of activity where they can contribute from a young age. And I'd say start at 4 in a very relaxed, fun way. And certainly by the time, 14 at the latest, the kids should be doing some meaningful adult-level work that gives them a sense of satisfaction, where people treat them like an adult. And if you, the parents, can't do that, then have them work with somebody who can. You know, one thing that that made a huge impression on our oldest son was how when he was 14, he went to help out with the convention of the Bhaktivedanta Institute, and they treated him like an adult. I mean, the downside of that is they sent him out on an errand, and by the time he came back, the temple was locked. And, you know, but he was really, really impressed with how he was treated, and it gave him some genuine self-esteem and really made him feel like a valued member of ISKCON. You know, if we say we want the children to be a valued member of ISKCON, then we need to be giving them some valuable, meaningful, real, adult-level service to do as young as possible. Now, sometimes the temples facilitate this, sometimes they don't. I was at one temple where the teenage devotees, even those who weren't so strict and, you know, were into this, they were all doing service. They were cutting the lawns, they were doing this. They felt like, I'm a member of ISKCON and I'm a valuable member of ISKCON and this is my community and this is my society. So having fun at home can really be a big step towards that, especially if the temple, you know, I don't know what the situation is at the temple here, but especially if the temple is not so amenable to having children do some service. Okay, what are the benefits? I'm sure there's more, but you have another one for that before you go?
In the context when, like, when you come from India and you come try to settle into the Western culture, so when the children see their parents are being charmed at home, so they join that. So they join that tradition. They join that sadhana with some real values. It's not, and they can present themselves into the public. Like for example, putting tilak. As in, if you really don't value the sadhana process yourself, it gets diluted to your children as well. Because you see, okay, this is something what you do, but we can't tell these others to follow. So that will give us more integrity and faith, and that we can transfer it to the child. So they can go, okay, I am vegetarian. And we see people, these children, they say, ah, oh, it's yuck. And you eat vegetarian food. So I think the children will get more confidence to say, no, I am vegetarian. And it makes no sense to be vegetarian. And that he can tell this to Western people. It is easy when we do it in home. We can tell
yes,
this.
I think the demigods are conspiring against us. thank you. That's a very good point. I would add, though, that, again, the relationships in the family should be one of real trust. So that in order for that to be accomplished, you'd be more likely to have that accomplished if the relationships with your children are one of deep friendship and trust. If it's not just something official. Otherwise, the children might think, yeah, this is just the ritualistic stuff my Indian parents do because they're old-fashioned from India. So So you want it to be something where you really communicate to them. And I'd say also, especially as they get older, that you really answer their deep questions about spiritual life. Now, this is something that I find that people sometimes have a hard time with. That the children, as they become teenagers, you want them to ask their real questions. And this applies to those of you who are running like Bhakti Shastri programs also with adults. You want to encourage people to ask their real questions. And in fact, the more challenging their questions are and the more offensive their questions are, now the mood shouldn't be challenging. The mood should be submissive. But the more the content is challenging, the more you want to encourage them to ask them. Why? If they don't ask the questions, then doubts will grow. Doubts will grow. So another way to give the children long-lasting faith is not only to do sadhana at home, but have it be at a very high quality. So now we're kind of moving into the area of how. And one of the hows, I would say, for sadhana at home, is that especially your scripture, your philosophy classes, should be at a very, very high level of quality. Which means you should, just like Prabhupada talked about, I think I mentioned this in class the other day, that the cobbler, you remember the story of Narada and the Brahmin and the cobbler? You all know that story? And the cobbler asked, what is Lord Narayan doing? And do you know what Narada said? What did he say? You're not sure? Good. He's putting an... Close. He's putting an elephant through a...
Needle.
So how big is the hole in the needle? It's only about this big, right? And Narada Muni said that Krishna is, Lord Narayan is putting an elephant through the eye of the needle. And then the cobbler said, oh, my Lord, it's wonderful. And Narada said, why do you believe me? And he said, well, if he can put a banyan tree in a seed, why can't he put an elephant in the eye of a needle? And Prabhupada said, the devotee's faith is not blind. So one thing to do to give our children faith, even in something simple like vegetarianism, they should know the why. And in order to do that, we have to encourage them, not just allow, but encourage them to ask difficult questions. I mean, one thing for me and many other people who came from other faiths to Krishna consciousness is we were asking our religious leaders questions, and they were saying, oh, you're not allowed to ask that question. You know, I mean, I remember asking, you know, Moses breaks the tablets at the bottom of Mount Sinai, and he goes up, and God says, we'll finish all these people and start over with you. I'll kill them all. And Moses says, no, don't do that. You promised Abraham that you would make his descendants numerous. And God says, yeah, you're right. I won't do it. Now, that didn't fit with the concept of an impersonal God. It didn't make any sense. I couldn't understand how God could get angry. And I couldn't understand how he could change his mind. And I couldn't understand how Moses could convince him to change his mind and tell him he'd made a mistake. It didn't make any sense to me with the idea of an impersonal God. But when I asked them, I don't understand this. They said, don't ask that question. So my response to that was to say, I'm going to look someplace else for my spiritual life. These people don't know what they're talking about. Now, it's all right to say I don't know. It's perfectly fine to say I don't know. In fact, better to say I don't know than to make something up. But we should have this mood. You know, for about 16 years, I taught Bhakti Shastri mostly to teenagers. And they had to come to every class with three questions of their own. And I said, you know, the best thing is if you come with a question I can't answer. So I would give them praise and rewards if they could come with a question I couldn't answer. I wanted them to really dig into their own doubts. I wanted their faith to be strong. And sometimes they'd ask questions that we probably wouldn't ask in the temple. We're talking again about the how and the why of doing sadhana at home. I remember one of them said to me, you know, in these purports, Srila Prabhupada's really criticizing Arjuna. You know, in the first chapter of Bhagavad Gita, he said, Prabhupada's really criticizing Arjuna. How is this not Vaishnava Para? So who would ask this in a temple? But I said to her, that's a fantastic question. I'm so glad you asked that. Right? So this is the way we're really not, the children are going to get their faith, not only from seeing us do it, but from seeing us go deep into our faith. From seeing us go deep in the books, really trying to understand things. And these are also the challenges that they're going to face to their faith from outside. Isn't it? People are going to ask them hard questions. Just like in my own upbringing, they had certain restrictions on diet, but I didn't know the reason for them. So I followed them till I was about 16, and then my friends would say, why can't you eat this? Why can't you eat this? Why? And I didn't know any reason. I couldn't explain it. And therefore, I wasn't able to continue it. So we really, one of the hows of having a program at home is take the opportunity to go deep. And one thing you can do is also have your children give the class. You know, even 7 or 8 year old children can sometimes give the class. And that pushes them to ask real questions. And of course, then you're training them to be preachers. Okay, now we're getting a little bit more into the how. What are some other ideas for how we can have sadhana at home? Are we trying again? Ever optimistic. Okay? All right, I hope we're in business now. Yes. The benefits and the downsides of modern technology. Okay, so what are some more hows? Of course, thank you very much for your tolerance and patience with this. What are some more hows of sadhana at home? Yes? Can you park it? Some more hows of sadhana at home? I want to get to it. Yes?
Your education of household atmosphere.
Okay, that's a why, but I want to move on now to the how.
Because otherwise...
No, but how? How? How do you do sadhana at home?
Because otherwise people can be abusive, they're fighting.
Oh, yes, that's true. Can you give us some suggestion for what's a good way to make sadhana at home easier? How can we make it easier? What are some ways that we can do it? What are some suggestions for how to make it easier so we'll be purified and not fight? Yes?
Krishna book reading at night.
Krishna book reading at night.
Look at the day, the schedule, what is the most easy for children to take it in. For example, like that if they should read Bhagavad Gita, like look at the time, the suitable and situation, and like think that the easiest for them, like the book reading at night.
Okay, so certain times of day may be easier for certain things. So this is a nice clue that we don't have to do all of our sadhana in the morning, that some of our sadhana can also be done at night. Prabhupada actually encouraged, he said, householders, either in the morning or the evening, can eat, or both, yeah, can gather together. We had a tradition in ISKCON for many, many years of reading Krishna book in the evening. If you can't read Krishna book, you can put on the recordings, like the CDs of Krishna stories, and play them for your children at night. Okay, what's another idea for how we can do sadhana at home? Yes?
Getting to bed on time.
Now, this involves, for most of us, getting rid of what? Getting rid of what? How do you all know that? So someone asked me in Brisbane, how do I get rid of my television? I said, well, there's this thing at the back. And you just follow it along the wall, and you pull hard. And then you place an ad on eBay, and, you know, then the thing is gone. And if you're really serious, just chuck it out the window. And then someone says, well, can we use it for devotional movies? I said, yes. If you can use it only for devotional movies, then keep it, but please be honest. Yeah. And also educational films are fine. You know, things on like nature, science, and things like that. I would advise on kind of a little separate note that from a medical point of view, that any kind of viewing, even of devotional movies, regardless of content, below the age of 4 or 5, permanently changes a child's brain. Permanently. There's no going back. So the suggestion from the non-devotee medical establishment is that you limit any kind of television movie viewing for children under the age of 5 to 2 hours a week. So that's devotional, educational, whatever. It actually changes the nature of the brain permanently. It's permanent damage. And those of us in education, we see that. It's quite clear what that does to children. So yeah, going to bed early often means getting rid of the television, or if you want to keep it for devotional things, hook it up so that you can't pull in other stuff. And not only television, also movies. Not everybody movies, and what's the other big one?
Internet.
The what?
Internet.
The what?
Internet.
You all sleeping? The what?
Internet.
Yeah, okay. Now, that's not a thing that's quite easy to check out the window, although some people do it. Some people can do that. But it's a good idea to try to regulate it. Now, one thing you can do, have the computers in a common room where everybody can see what everybody else is doing. Oh, another thing with television, I was just reading a study that children who have televisions in their own room are much more likely to be obese, to be poor students, to get diabetes, and so forth. That if they have a television in their own room as opposed to the living room. Just that one thing. Now, they don't know why. The supposition is that they watch a lot more of it if it's in their own room. So if you're not willing to pull the plug, at least move it to the living room, regulate the time. So internet also, now some of the most damaging things on the internet, especially for the children, are what? The games. Of all the games, which are the most damaging to sadhana? Of all the computer games, which are the most damaging to sadhana? The very violent games, especially the games, I don't know if you all know what I'm talking about, called first-person shooters. You know what I'm talking about? Where all the person playing the game sees is their hand and the gun. And those games are often very, very violent. Actually, one of Prabhupada's main objections to television was the violence. So in these first-person shooter games, you're actually taking the role of a terrorist or a gang member or something like that. I mean, it's real. I've never played these games, but I have had people visit my house for a weekend or something and pull out their computer and play games. And I've had Krishna's give me the opportunity to see what it does to people. And I saw one teenage boy, got up at 5, I don't even know if he went to use the toilet, got right on the computer. And he stayed there for 15 hours. There with his family, visiting us with his family. Hey, come on, time for breakfast. Yeah, just 1 minute. Didn't even drink water for 15 hours. Didn't bathe, didn't drink water. And recently, I went to visit the home of some devotee friends I hadn't seen for a very, very long time, like 5 years. And go in the house and, you know, the family greets me, and then the wife just disappears. You know, so I'm talking with the husband, who's one of my former students, and their kids, and, you know, he's showing me his altar, this and that. And finally I say, is your wife sick? No, she's playing a game. Since I haven't seen her for 5 years, you know, she just said hello, and then she just disappeared. And as I'm leaving, she comes back out and says, really, I'm really sorry that I couldn't talk to you anymore, but, you know, we had to get this treasure now with the team, and I just couldn't wait. So the first-person shooter, what are the other kinds of the very violent games, what are the other kinds of computer games that are really detrimental to sadhana? Well, that's a name. I don't know the specific name. I assume that that's a game like that. An army shooter game. So the real heavy-duty shooter game, and there's another kind of game besides the heavy-duty shooter games that I've seen are especially detrimental to sadhana. Does anybody know what they are? Oh, yeah, well, that's also a very violent one. By the way, you guys, if you're not familiar with these games, your kids may be. That was something I saw as a Gurukul teacher. We had rules about television, but we didn't have rules about computer games. And I was just floating in ignorance. Well, I'm not floating in ignorance anymore. So I see a lot of you don't know what's out there. So it'd be a good idea to find out. The other kind of games that are the most dangerous and detrimental to the children's sadhana and Krishna consciousness are the fantasy role-playing games, where you're playing with many other people at the same time. Everyone's on the internet at once. It's a whole fantasy world. And everyone creates their own character. And that's the game that this boy was playing when he didn't get off the computer for 15 hours. They're very, very, very absorbing. And I've seen that children who get involved in those games, there's no sense of consciousness of Krishna that's finished. They're just conscious of the game. It becomes a completely absorbing experience. What I also saw with those games particularly for the boys, that when people become teenagers, they have a very strong desire. Your desire to be an adult becomes very, very strong, right? Once you get to like 12, 13. And this manifests in a desire to master something, to become an expert at something. That's hardwired into our psyche because, well, girls want to master things too, especially boys, because they have to earn a living, right? So what happens is these game manufacturers, they're so nasty that they're taking this natural urge of the young boy to become a master at something and they're diverting it into these games, which is useless. What does it matter if you master the game? Right? But they're taking that natural energy, that natural inclination, and they're channeling into this just so they can make money. And then the young man, and also increasingly the girls, but it's more men, then they don't have any inclination to learn something practical in the world. Not until they have no inclination for Krishna, but they have no inclination to learn something practical in the world. And one of the cures for that, as I said, is to give them some adult responsibility in service from a young age. By the way, I have noticed that the children who are given adult responsibility and service from a young age are much less inclined to get addicted to computer games. They may play some here and there of the milder form. This is what I've seen. But they don't get involved in the very violent ones or the very entangling ones. Why? Because they're satisfied. They don't need to be a false master in a world of illusion when they can be a master of something that's tangible. Okay, so getting rid of the distractions, getting to bed on time. What's another how for doing sadhana at home?
Not giving the what he wants, we can do higher days. Like if children want to play something, we can arrange to play Krishna consciousness games, like in a layer of extraction games.
That takes a lot of resources and a lot of planning. I mean, that's a nice idea. But the fact is that we have very limited resources. And parents often don't have a whole lot of time to sit down and develop all kinds of alternate entertainment for their children. I would suggest again that giving children real meaningful responsibility that's very satisfying to them will generally take care of those things to a large extent. But let's move on to another area. So how else can we do sadhana at home? Yes.
Having routine.
Now, for some people, this really makes it for them, that we're going to have our Mangal Arati every day at 5 o'clock. We're going to do this at this time. And there's some. I know some people in their homes who have been doing this for years. But I should also say that there are some people, I'm sure in this audience, who routine doesn't work very well for. Okay? If we study personality styles, we find that some people are what's called sequential and some people are what's called random. And only 40% of people are naturally sequential and 60% of people are random. So random is also called lateral. Sequential people are linear thinkers and random people are lateral thinkers. Lateral thinkers are much more creative, much more flexible, they're much more adaptable, but they have a hard time with the routine. Okay? And people who are very, very good at keeping a routine also tend to be not so flexible and so creative. Okay? So there's... You're not going to find the ideal. So my suggestion is that if you're more of a lateral thinker type, then probably setting up a routine will just be frustrating to you. And we find this also. People say, okay, to do my sadhana, I have to start my sadhana every day at 4:30. I have to start my sadhana every day at 5. But they're just not those kind of people. They're not these super organized people. It's just not how they run their life. And they keep thinking, when I get organized, then I'll be Krishna conscious. When I get organized, then I'll be Krishna. First I have to get organized, and then I can be Krishna conscious. So my suggestion to you is whether or not you ever get organized, just become Krishna conscious. Because first of all, you may never be organized, just like the very organized person may never be creative. That's okay. You don't have to be a materially organized person, nor do you have to be a materially creative person in order to be Krishna conscious. Both types of people can be Krishna conscious. So if you're the kind of person for whom a routine is very easy, and that's the way you structure your life, then please set a routine for your sadhana. If you're the kind of person that you're very spontaneous and you're very flexible, do we have all kinds of people who are very advanced devotees in the Hare Krishna movement? Do we have some very advanced leaders who are always running to different places and changing their schedule every moment, being completely flexible and adaptable, whatever comes their way, they just go for it and throw out all their other plans? Do we have leaders like that who are very advanced in Krishna consciousness?
Do we have some very advanced Krishna conscious devotee who do the same service at the same time every day for 40 years? Okay, so there's room for both. You don't have to be one and you don't have to be the other. Wherever you are, you are. It's like if you have black hair, you don't have to dye blonde. If you have blonde hair, you don't have to dye black. Just whatever it is, you become Krishna conscious. Okay, so if you're one of the kinds of people who likes to have some flexibility, then just accept it. Then you work out something that works for you. So one thing you could say is, well, we'll have our morning program every morning before 6, and we'll spend at least 20 minutes on kirtan, and at least 20 minutes on class, and at least 20 minutes on family job, but that's 1 hour. You know, or we'll make sure we read a little from this every day. You work out something that's going to work for you. So part of making sadhana work at home is work out a program that works for you, that's in harmony with the kind of personality that you have. And that also means in harmony with the kind of job you have, or the kind of school you go to. You know, if your job starts at 5 in the morning, you probably have to adjust when you do your sadhana. Now, having said all that, sometimes the wife is one type and the husband's another. Right?
Most
of the time? Maybe. There's advantages to each, by the way. You know, if both the husband and the wife are both lateral types, you know, they'll probably have a lot of fun, but they may not get a lot done. So if you're both the same type, that has some disadvantages and advantages, and if you're opposite type, that has some advantages and disadvantages. And we should just say that right now. This also relates to your questions about, suppose only one person is Krishna conscious. Is there any situation in the material world that is 100% favorable for Krishna consciousness? No. From Mordramad's planet all the way down to the hellish planet, there's going to be problems. There's going to be things that make your Krishna consciousness difficult. You know, there may be a day or a week or a month or maybe a year when you don't have any major impediments to your Krishna consciousness. But don't expect that you're going to be able to adjust the material energy so it will always be favorable. That's what the materialists are trying to do. They're trying to adjust the material energy so they'll never suffer. And if we think I'm going to adjust the material energy so I'll always have the easiest way to be Krishna conscious, it's the same mentality. So better, you do your best to make some adjustments to make it favorable. Do your best for whatever situation you have, be Krishna conscious with that. So if the husband and wife have different ways of doing things, maybe you could take turns, maybe some days you do it according to the way the husband likes, and some days you do it according to the way the wife likes. You know, or else one person just has to go, all right, I guess we're doing it the other way. So you may have to do it that way too. Right? And in practical life, it won't always be the wife who ends up going along with the husband. I mean, that may be theoretically nice, but I know that that's not actually what's going to happen. You know, family. Some husbands, if they want to have sadhana with their family, they're going to have to do it in a way that's comfortable with their wife. I mean, isn't that true? Right? We can say theoretically it shouldn't be true, but that might be true. So you can go with one person's style, or you can have some things that are there for each person's style. Okay, what are some other ideas for how we can do sadhana at home? Yes? Teamwork and sharing responsibility. Well, first of all, that assumes that the husband and wife want to be a team in sadhana and want to share responsibilities in sadhana, which they may or may not. But if they do, then that's a very good idea. That's a very good idea. And also have some teamwork with your children, especially if they're young and you can get them involved from the beginning. Okay, some other ideas. Yes. Keep it simple. Yes, I would really advise keep it simple. By the way, this also means who you're worshiping. Okay? It's really funny because the other day I just heard Srila Prabhupada say something which I've been saying for years, and I was so happy I heard him saying it. So especially, excuse me, but you know, Westerners have their forms of Maya and Indians have their forms of Maya. Right? We each have our own brand. Some are vanilla, some are strawberry. So Indian Maya is often that you want a supermarket altar. So maybe you've gotten rid of all your day deities, but you still have like 10 deities of Krishna and 10 deities of Jagannath and 12 deities of Gaur Nitai. Okay? So keep it simple. You're not going to be more of a devotee by the number of deities that are in your house. Krishna doesn't say in the Bhagavad Gita that the more deities you put in your house, the faster you will go back to Godhead. Do something you can maintain that's in terms of your worship. Far better to have just 20 tai and take care of them nicely than to have, you know, 20 sets of deities that are being ignored. So you invite Krishna, it's a serious matter. He's not just a death ornament, right? And sometimes, especially with the Westerners, we see this, but I'm seeing it more and more with the Indians, that with the altar is next to the TV, or the altar is on top of the TV. But yeah, no, do keep your worship simple, keep your program simple, do something that you can maintain. You can always do more on a special day, but do something that you can maintain. Actually, the Maharshi Devotion, Srila Prabhupada defines over-endeavor as taking a vow in spiritual life that you can't maintain. So do something you can maintain. If you can maintain 10, 15 minutes of scripture reading, do that. You can always do an hour or something. You can do a 10-minute kirtan. If you can maintain that, do that. Okay. What are the most essential items in sadhana? What are the most potent items? Does anyone know, any of our bhakti shastris here? Chanting, yeah, okay, holy name. Deity worship. Sadhu Sangha. Mature Vash, right, having a holy place, and? You said deity worship? Bhagavatam and Shastra. Okay, so chanting the holy name, worshipping the deity, the Bhagavatam, Shastra in general, associating with saintly persons, and living in a holy place. So you want to turn your home into a holy place. But those five items should form the core of your sadhana. So another thing to make sadhana at home easy is you have a sacred space. And sacred space doesn't just mean you set up an altar. It means that that's a space that's reserved for the sacred. That ideally there's not a lot of talking going on in front of that space. There's not eating going on in front of that space. Ideally, as far as possible. And sometimes the structure of the home doesn't allow for this. But as far as possible. We were talking this morning about triggers. Right? And that should be an area that's reserved for spiritual activities. Okay, so we can have a special time, a routine, a special place. Also, what's very helpful with children is you have some kind of chart for their responsibilities or their progress, and you give them some kind of recognition, some kind of star. I know some parents who make a little book for their kids. That's something you fold with paper and staple, where they can get different prizes. So they get like 10 stars on a page, they get a prize. And they have a choice of, you know, 10 different prizes, so there's 10 different pages. And the prizes are all devotional things, like some mahaprasadam from the temple, or a chance to make giwiks for the deities, or, you know, daddy will read you a Krishna story, or something like that. And the children get to choose, you know, when they've done something nicely, they chanted japa nicely, or they've offered artik, or they've led the kirtan, and they get the little sticker. When they fill up their page, they can decide what page they want their sticker on, and they can decide what kind of prize they want to get. Another thing I found helpful is sometimes getting together with other families. So sometimes getting together with other families. If it's just your family, you know, you may not get out of bed at 4 o'clock. But if you know somebody else is going to be there at 5, then you're going to get out of bed. And also it's a lot more enlivening when you have a bigger group of people. Another thing that's helpful is to have, say, one day a week or a couple of days a month where you come to the temple. You know, you have your at-home days and you have your temple days. Okay, I think that we've... Okay. Let's go on now to sadhana at a temple. So what are the benefits for the children of sadhana at a temple? Get inspired. Actually, you know what I want to do right now? Can everybody stand up? I want to take a minute break. Okay, let's touch the ceiling. Touch your toes. Oh. Are we talking about time for exercise every day, right? Touch the ceiling. Touch your toes. Okay, sit down. Thank you. Does everything here look very interesting to you? So some The benefits of going to the temple with your children is they really feel part of the community. Also, the kirtans are going to be more enlivening, right? You don't have to cook that day. You can have some time, especially if you work this out in advance with other families. If you arrange with like 5 other families, hey, why don't we make every other Saturday of the month a temple day? Then it can be a time when you can have your socialization with other families in the context of Krishna consciousness. And it also really helps connect children to the greater ISKCON. So how can we make sadhana at a temple easier? What can we do to make having our sadhana at the temple easier? Waking up early, which means going to bed early. Any other ideas? Huh? Living reasonably close to the temple. If you just go to the temple occasionally, it's not that hard. But yeah, living, not having it a 3-hour drive. Okay, get a relationship with the temple devotees. And that means, especially as your kids grow up, having your kids have a relationship with the temple devotees. To give services. One of the things that will bring you to the temple is if you say every Saturday I'm going to do XYZ service. Then you obligate yourself to go. You know, if you say every Saturday I'm going to make the garland for Jagannath. Right? And especially as your children get a little older, if the temple authorities are open to it, then you can arrange that your children also do some service. They can make the ghee-wick, they can help make the garland. They can, I know some, again, it depends what they allow to do, but some temples they allow the older children to polish the silver. By older, I mean like 9, 10.
But the ladies can come to me after
all the theater. Okay, look at that. There we go. You can sign up for service right here. So that's getting your children involved. The children will really look forward to it. Wow, that's my day to go to the temple and make ghee-wick. Or that's my day to go to the temple and polish the silver. Or that's my day to go work in the office and help with the layout for the new newsletter. Or whatever it is that they're involved with. Another thing is to really talk to the devotees at the temple, and we have some of the temple devotees here, about encouraging a welcoming attitude for the children. And, you know, especially some of the temple residents who've never married, they're already like 40 years old and they've never had kids, they may not really understand the needs of children. So this may require some education on the part of the parents. You know, I spent 17 years training children in the morning program. So up to 30 children that I was taking with me through the morning program. And I many instances, but I'm thinking one case, it was this little boy who had a lot of energy. And like he raced around Tulsi, and the devotees would say, can't you get him to slow down? I said, he'll automatically slow down when he's 12, don't worry about it. But, you know, they really couldn't understand. And I said, you know, look, he has really high energy parents. And they said, no, he doesn't. His parents are really peaceful. I said, look, his father's running a temple and a restaurant and goes out on book distribution. I said, now that's a high energy person who's channeled his energy. But what is the 6-year-old going to do with it? I said, someday he may be leading a festival party like Indrajumna Swami, and right now he's racing around Tulsi. So, you know, getting people to have a different view of the children, a different view of the children, to see them as potential adults, to see their so-called bad qualities as good qualities that don't have proper expression. Also, sometimes you can try to work out with the temples a place for the mothers with young children to go. Now, what we usually did when our kids were young, we had a speaker set up so we could hear the class in that room. And we'd often buy a cabinet. Sometimes I have to be the one who bought it, you know, and get some toys to keep in there so it was something for the kids to do during the morning program. Now, another thing that I did was I had special, when my children were very young, had special japa toys, toys that my kids only saw during japa. And I had about 5 different of them, so I'd rotate them. And also special Bhagavatam class toys that were quiet, like self-books and stuff, you know. And again, rotate them. So the kids only saw those toys during japa or during Bhagavatam class. So they didn't get bored of them. And by the time the kids were 7, they had to take notes in class. No coloring, or actually probably didn't want people doing anything in Bhagavatam class except for listening, but that's another topic. Yeah. Prabhupada would see people doing things in the class. He'd say, don't divert your attention. Just listen. So I always try to train the children, at least from the age of 7, just to really listen and take notes. Otherwise they can be going and they don't even absorb anything. But this also may mean talking with the people who give class that the classes should be children friendly. Right? I mean, I've heard people get up on the Vyasa Sun and say, just like all of us were born in a low family. And afterwards I go up to them and I say, did you see that a third of the people in the class were children born in the Hare Krishna movement? And they just don't notice that they're there. So this may mean also talking with the people who give class. You know, we are bringing our children. Please also, whenever you can, try to include them in your presentation and to acknowledge that they're there. All right. So we're about to go on to the next phase. What I could talk about just briefly were the questions that were brought up while we're having this being passed around. There's no way that this is enough for everybody. Families, please share. Because there's not enough for each person to get one. Okay, so the questions were asked at the beginning, before we go on to this last very short phase, about what do we do about outside influence? What do we do about outside influence? And I think I dealt with this mostly in my presentation this morning. That the main thing we do about outside influence is we make the inside influence really powerful. We make the inside influence really powerful. And as far as possible, as far as practical, as far as you can, limit your children's outside influence, especially when they're very young. Especially when they're very young. To people who are going to be respectful of your lifestyle. And, you know, the sad truth is we really need our own schools and we really need homeschooling. I mean, that's the sad truth. And when we don't have that, we're in a very difficult situation. Someone asked me also about the stages. I think you asked about the stages and what children should do at different stages. So Prabhupada said we welcome first day babies to the Bhagavatam class. And so certainly we can be involving our children from the very beginning. There's a group of educators in Australia and New Zealand who recommend reading books to your children from day one. So, and then there are people, you know, who read books to their children in the womb, and their children end up as mathematicians and things like that because they're reading math textbooks from the pregnancy stage. So, but we can do this in Krishna consciousness. In fact, one of my former students, who's now 29, remembers when she was in her mother's womb and her father was reading Chaitanya Charitamrita. She actually was able to describe to her parents exactly what was going on when she was in the womb. So certainly you can start from the time that a woman is pregnant. You can be playing classes, playing kirtans, Prahlad learned in the womb. And you can be taking them to either your home sadhana or the temple sadhana from as early as possible. You can certainly do that. Now, when should you expect them to start participating? Well, you know, two-year-olds love to help out. Of course, they don't help out very well, but they want to do something. You know, you can put, after you finish your arti, you can put a flower in the shop, or as the Australians say, arti. After you finish your arti. I came in, they're going, we're going to Mangal Arti. I'm like, what? So even with your two-year-old, although I'm sure I don't pronounce it very well either, even with your two-year-old, you can put a flower in her hand, you know, and she can ring the bell and things like that. Right? Give them some kind of engagement. Now, by the time that a child would enter Gurukul, which is age 5, by that time you can certainly expect them to be participating in your program. Now, that will work best if they had some degree of participation even before that. And if you were letting them sleep until 9, until they were 5, and all of a sudden you want to wake them up at 4, that's not going to work very well. And from the time from their 5 until their 10, you can gradually, very, very gradually, expect them to take on more responsibilities. By the time children are about 9 or 10, depending on their reading ability, they should be able to read Srila Prabhupada's books. And what we did in Gurukula is we had the children read a section from Prabhupada's book and write an essay on it. And if you want to see some examples of that, I think it's still up. If you go to the website of Bir Krishna Maharaj, do you know who he is? He does visit Melbourne sometimes. So you know who Bir Krishna Swami is? You know who he is? He does come here, but he goes to people's homes. He doesn't come to the temple. But I know he comes to Melbourne. I know he comes to Sydney. Does he ever come to Melbourne?
No,
just Sydney. Only Sydney. Okay.
Last year.
He was there just a few weeks ago. Okay. But he doesn't come this far south. Someone told me he came to Sydney and Melbourne. Anyway, on his website, which I think BK Goswami, there's a section there actually from one of my grandchildren who's being homeschooled. And I hate to use my grandchildren as an example, but that's just what's up on the web. And it says Padma's Chaitanya Charitamrita writing. So if you want to see a nice example of the kind of thing, she's 9, of the kind of thing you can engage a child of about the age of 9 or 10 in doing from Prabhupada's books, you can look on that site. I think it's vkgoswami.com. And if you look where it says Padma's work on Chaitanya Charitamrita. So up to 10, you can start, you know, gradually expecting more and more responsibility. Then certainly from 10 to 16, you can expect that they're going to take some really solid responsibility. Okay, you know, you can give class on Tuesday, and I'll give class on Wednesday, and your father will give class on Thursday, and you know, but you can also work this out as a group, not just ordering, you do this, you do that, you do the other thing. But okay, here we have these duties, what would you like to do, how would you like to do it? You can ask their suggestions for what changes they'd like to see in the morning program, how they'd like to contribute to it. Okay, now our next, what we're going to end with, is how we can stay inspired. Because we can get all excited, okay, I'm going to have this nice sadhana program, and then it's hard to maintain it. Right? Does that happen?
Yes.
Yes. Okay, so how we can stay inspired. So we're going to look at 6 areas. Part of modern society. Background music. Okay. The first thing is practical help. Can everyone say help?
Help.
Help. Everybody.
Help.
Oh, that's much better. Okay. So getting practical help. Now, in a natural society, you have an extended family. How many of you here are living as part of an extended family? Can you raise your hands a little higher? I don't think it's 0. Wow, not very many, huh? Not very many. Alright, so normally in an extended family, people help out. The housewife doesn't have to cook every meal, every day. Right? The man doesn't have to do all of the house maintenance. You have uncles and aunties and brothers and sisters to help. Now often today with extended family, people have more trouble with the extended family than they have help from it. But still, there's a community of help. Right? So since most of us don't have that, then we can try to create our own extended family. We can become our own community and help each other. Share cooking duties sometimes. You know, get together with another 2 or 3 families. But sometimes one of the ladies cooks for everybody, sometimes somebody else cooks for everybody. You know, have some shared responsibilities. Have people you can call on for practical help with your life so that you don't feel overburdened by everything. So that's the first one, which is?
No.
Okay. Second one is nourishment. Can we say?
Nourishment.
This means that on a regular basis, this is something like, you know, if you're using a towel, it has to dry sometimes. You can't just have it wet all the time. So you can't just always be giving. Giving to your wife, giving to your children, giving to your husband, giving to your children. Sometimes you have to be plugged in, like our poor little microphone here. Right? It had to get a new battery, had to get charged. So on a daily basis, you want to do something that's really spiritually nourishing. So that means 2 areas. First, take the sadhana that you're already doing and make sure it's of really deep quality. Don't do your sadhana mechanically. Don't do it as a ritual. Do it in a deep way. Chant with affection for Krishna. Read with interest. Have your regular spiritual activities be nourishing. And in addition, take some time on a regular basis, whether it's daily or weekly, to do some spiritual activity that you really like. So if every day you're reading from Bhagavatam, maybe you like to read from Krishna book, or you like to read from Nectar Devotion, Or maybe you like to learn the songs of Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Or maybe you like to make garlands. Or do something that you really, really enjoy doing for Krishna. At least once in a week. Give yourself a half an hour, whatever. And periodically, and this means that husband, wife, children have to help them, you know, this is my time. My time for my nourishment. My time for my recharging. And it should be, again, something that you really, really like, something you can look forward to. You're sewing something, you're cooking something, you're building something, you're doing some service for the temple that you really like, or you have your own preaching project that you're working on. And then periodically, you want to do something that lasts a little longer. Now, this can be tricky, because if that means going to India, that can be exhausting rather than nourishing also. So, you know, you want to do something that's going to be genuinely nourishing. So that should be every day. Every single day, part of your day should be done, unless there's some crisis that day, every day should be spent in something that is spiritually nourishing to you. Every single day. Which means take what you're ordinarily doing and find the depth in it. And periodically do things that you enjoy that are spiritual. So right now we have... Okay. And now this is a fun one. Our next one is fans. Everybody say? Okay, we don't mean the things that revolve and give you air. We mean the rah, rah, rah. Do you have cheerleaders here? In Australia? Do you have cheerleaders? You do, okay. The sporting, the like football team, I thought they have the cheerleaders? Go, team, go. Go, team, go. Right? Yeah, there you go. So, you need people who are going to be saying, yeah, wow. You cook a nice meal for your husband every day. That's wonderful. Krishna must be so happy with you. Wow, you've been going to that accounting job every day for the last 20 years and taking nice care of your family. Just see how happy Srila Prabhupada is with you. You changed how many suli napkins yesterday? 4 in one day? Whoa, that's wonderful. Yeah, see, right now we do that for the book distributors, right? We read the announcements every day to the deities. So-and-so distributed so many Bhagavad Gitas, but nobody ever gets up there or have this experience. I'm going on a book distribution. Ermila distributed 600 back to Godhead, and everybody goes, Haribo, and they gave me a maha plate. But nobody ever got up there and said, you know, Ermila changed 4 Suli Nappies yesterday. That never happened. So we all need some cheerleaders. We all need some cheerleaders. And one way you can get that is be a cheerleader for somebody else. And Krishna will reciprocate. Find somebody who's doing some service that you don't normally appreciate, that you don't normally think about, and give them some encouragement. And give encouragement to each other. And if nobody's giving you encouragement, go to the Shastra, go to Srila Prabhupada, find some quotes. I have some quotes on that paper there that may be in that category. And put them on your wall. You know, or have a little file box of quotes that you read every once in a while. Oh, yeah, Prabhupada's pleased with what I'm doing. Krishna's pleased with what I'm doing. You know, find your fan club there in the Shastra. So far we have... come on, we can do better than that. Okay, now the next one, we don't like so much. This is correction. Correction. One way to stay inspired is to make sure we're on the right track. How long are you going to keep going if you're on the wrong road and you're not getting anywhere? Right? If we're not getting any happiness from our service, and therefore we get discouraged, then probably we're on the wrong road. We need somebody to tell us, hey, you're on the wrong road. Now, everyone should have at least one person in their life where they can go to that person and say, what am I doing wrong? And that person's going to be able to be honest with you. And best if you have a person who's willing to be honest with you even when you don't ask. Now, most of us do not have a person like that, is my guess. But we should really, you know, if you want that, Krishna will send. Try to get one, at least one person in your life who's willing to come up to you and say, you know, Armila, you're off. And where I say, yeah. Thanks for telling me. Right? No matter how my false ego may be yelling inside at first. And where I'm willing to take it and really take it on board and really think about this. Now this includes self-evaluation, which is why we have this little form for you to do at home. So this also means periodically doing the self-evaluation. I suggest that you photocopy this form and go through it at least 2 or 3 times a year. The GBC just went through an evaluation form as to how they're doing with leaders, and they found it very, very helpful. So to periodically look at yourself, I mean, do it every day if you can. Every day when you go to bed, just think, you know, how much of the time today did I spend thinking of Krishna? What percentage of my time was I absorbed in Krishna's name, form, qualities, and pastimes? How did I treat other living entities? How did I contribute to the Sankirtan mission? How was my sadhana? A little, you know, 1 minute self-evaluation every day. So, correction. So we have... All right. Now this next one is colleagues. So other people who are doing the same kind of work that we're doing. And this, by the way, can be devotees or non-devotees. It doesn't necessarily have to be devotees. So if you want some help with being a parent, talk to other people who are parents. You have your first child, you're only 3 months old, you don't know what to do. Get some good books on parenting, or go to some outside seminar. You know, if you're a doctor, have some association with other doctors. Be with some people who understand the intricacies of your own work and your own life, and who can give you practical advice and help and encouragement. See, your fans may not know what's going on in your life, right? They may not be able to give you any practical guidance, but they just encourage you. Yeah, wow, it's so nice that you're raising your family in Krishna consciousness. But colleagues are people that they're walking down the same road with you. And you're saying, oh, I'm having this problem with my child. And they say, well, I do too. And the other parent says, well, I do too. And the other parent says, well, I do too. And then you think, oh, this is just what happens. It's just normal. You get more of a perspective on your life. So the fifth one is colleagues. So let's say,
help.
Colleagues. All right, the last one is a little tricky. Often we think that when we take up spiritual life and we have times when we feel great spiritual happiness, enlightenment, and we say, I want that to go on forever, isn't it? And we think that to be always inspired in spiritual life means that it should always be easy, it should always be blissful. Now, it certainly will get to that point after most of our anarthas are cleared away, after we're free of the main influence of the mode of passion and ignorance, and we come to nishtha. Prabhupada says, until nishtha, it's a hard struggle with determination, and after that, things come easier. Not that one doesn't do anything, though, but things come more easily and naturally. But while we're in the stage of unsteady sadhana bhakti, then we're going to be affected by the modes of nature. Now, even after nishtha, the modes of nature will still affect our body. And Prabhupada has this wonderful thing to say in the purport of Bhagavad Gita 14:22-25, where Arjuna asks, what are the symptoms of one who's transcended the mode of nature? You don't have that. I didn't copy that. Okay, he says that when a living entity stays in the material world, embodied by the material body, it is to be understood that he is under the control of one of the three modes of material nature. When he's actually out of the body, then he is out of the clutches of the material modes of nature. But as long as he's not out of the material body, he should be neutral. So that means as long as we have a material body, the modes are going to affect us. Sometimes we're going to feel physically, mentally, emotionally enlivened and happy. Sometimes we're going to feel physically, mentally, and emotionally down and tired. We shouldn't think that the times when the modes are affecting us in such a way that we feel full of energy, that we're doing spiritually better, and the times when the modes affect us in such a way that we're more lethargic, that we're not doing spiritually better. The modes are going to be affecting us until we have come to the stage of nishtha, until we have cleared out most of our anarthas. So Prabhupada says we should take a neutral attitude towards these modes. Now I also would like to read something, and this is what we'll end with, and then we'll take about 5 minutes for questions. I'd also like to read something from a Christian writer, C.S. Lewis. This is from his book, The Screwtape Letters, which both Ravindra Sri Prabhu and Jai Gotamara says is one of their favorite books. And it's a very unusual book. But he's describing the situation of the modes of nature. And I think that we'll find this very, very helpful as to how to maintain our enthusiasm through the ups and downs of material life. He says, has no one ever told you about the law of undulation? Undulation is going up and down. As spirits, humans belong to the eternal world, but their bodies and minds inhabit time. This means that while their spirit can be directed to an eternal object, their bodies, passions, and imaginations are in continual change, for to be in time means to change. Their nearest approach to constancy, therefore, is undulation, the repeated return to a level from which they repeatedly fall back, a series of troughs and peaks. You can see this undulation in every department of life, in work, affection for friends, physical appetites, all go up and down. As long as one lives on earth, periods of emotional and bodily richness and liveliness will alternate with periods of numbness and poverty. One must ask what use God wants to make of the dryness and dullness phase. In God's efforts to get personal possession of a soul, he relies on the troughs even more than on the peaks. Some of his special favorites have gone through longer and deeper troughs than anyone else. The reason is this. The obedience which God demands is not the absorption of the soul's will into his, but quite a different thing. He wants servants who can become like sons. He is full and flows over. He wants a world full of beings that are united to him, but yet distinct. And that is where the troughs come in. You might wonder why God does not make more use of his power to be sensibly present to human beings in any degree he chooses and at every moment. But the irresistible and the indisputable are the two weapons which the very nature of his desire forbids him to use. Merely to override a human will, as his felt presence in any but the faintest and most mitigated degree would most certainly do, would be for him useless. He wants the living beings to be one with him, but yet themselves. Merely to cancel them or assimilate them will not serve. He is prepared to do a little overriding at the beginning. He will set them off with communications of his presence, which, though faint, seem great to them, with emotional sweetness and easy conquest over temptation. But he never allows this state of affairs to last for long. Sooner or later, he withdraws, if not in fact, at least from their conscious experience, all those supports and incentives. He leaves the entity to stand on its own legs, to carry out from the will alone duties which have lost all relish. It is during such trial periods, much more than during the peak periods, that the living being is growing into the sort of being he wants it to be. Hence, the prayers offered in the state of dryness are those which please him best. He wants the living being to learn to walk and must therefore take away his hand. And if only the will to walk is really there, he is pleased even with their stumbles. Illusion is never more in danger than when a human being, no longer desiring but still intending to do the will of God, looks round upon a universe from which every trace of him seems to have vanished and asks why he's been forsaken and still obeys. So we have 5 minutes if you want to have any general questions, and then we will end for the whole day. Yes?
From which age we should actually allow children to fast on
a codicil? Oh, okay. From which age should children fast on a codicil? In some of the scriptures it says 5 and in some it says 8. Certainly the children can fast from grains and beans from the beginning. I mean, it's not a hardship to fast from grains and meat. As far as doing a full fast, I think that depends on the child. I mean, personally, I would never, ever tell a child that they have to fast, do a full fast. Make a full fast one of those adult markers. I mean, all the devotee children that I know are really, really proud of the first day they were able to fast. Because to them, it's a real adult marker. So you're far better off by telling the children, no, you can't fast for your child. Much, much, much better. No, children can't fast. You're too little to fast. Much, much better. Tell them you're too little to fast. And encourage them not to fast. They'll really look forward to it. I mean, really, every devotee kid I know, they're like, yeah, and they must be, I fasted until 7. Wow. You know, they're really excited about it. Do you remember? Yes.
Well, Prabhupada says that you can mold the children till they're 16.
So after your children are 16, you can't mold them anymore. You have until 16, folks. Okay? That's it. So the children will grow up, 16 will come like that. It really will. Your ability to mold them and influence them is still 16. After 16, you can influence them only in the way I can influence you, by your voluntary acceptance. That's all. After 16, you can influence them like you influence another adult. And that's all. Nothing, they don't want more. Of course, if they're living in your house and you're maintaining them, you can certainly deal with them as you deal with any other adult who is living in your house and you're maintaining. You can say, look, you're living in my house, I'm maintaining you. These are the rules of the house. If you don't want to follow the rules of the house, you have to maintain yourself. If you say that, though, you've got to be prepared that they might want to move out and maintain yourself. Okay, you follow? So everything has its costs and benefits. So if you don't want to say, I'm maintaining you, this is my house rules, then you may have to put up with them doing something in your house that you don't like. Your choice, whatever you're more comfortable with. But just please be honest, you know, we're not in a traditional society. That is gone. We talked about that this morning, right? Those of you who were here this morning, we're no longer in a little village where everybody's setting the same example, where all children only see that people are respectful to their superiors. That is not our situation. Do our children see that people disrespect their superiors? They see it all the time. They see it at school. Those of you who went to school in India, you have no idea what goes on in the schools in the West. You would be shocked. You're sending your kids to these schools, you don't know what's going on there. I mean, you really would be shocked. It's not anything like what you grew up with. It really isn't. So the children at school, they're disrespecting their superior. If they're seeing things on the media, even if you've gotten rid of your Kaliyuga sanctity, I'm sure they see them sometimes at other people's homes. Right? They're seeing children talk back to their superiors, wives talk back to their husbands, employees to their bosses, parents yelling at teachers. I mean, they're seeing everywhere they turn a lack of respect for authority. So if you in your home just try to say, I don't care if you're 18, you have to do what I say because I'm your father. It's just, all you'll do is push their rebellion secret. You know, I'm sorry. I'm not saying that this is the way it should be, but I'm saying this is the way it is. Unfortunately, it's the way it is. We just don't have support from the society. So once they're 16, you have a choice of either letting them do something in your house that you don't want, or saying, as long as you're in my house, you follow the rules. At which point they may say, okay, I won't be in your house anymore. This may not be a bad choice, by the way. I'm serious. It may not be a bad choice.
What's the best thing?
But actually, what's the best thing?
There's not one best thing. It depends on you and it depends on the kid and the circumstance. It's individual. What are the possibilities for an older child who doesn't want to follow?
How to correct that?
Okay, a child over the age of 16 is like an adult. Their mentality is not that of a child. So if you had an adult who wasn't your child, who was living in your house, what would you do? Those are your list of possibilities.
You can sit down and negotiate with them. You can say, look, I understand you have these needs, I have these needs, let's try to work it out so both our needs are met. You can use negotiation skills. Okay? Obviously you can yell and scream at them. You can threaten them, you can throw things at them. No, that's an option. I don't think it'll work very well. You can tolerate them doing what they want. You can say, you know, you can draw a line and say, look, this is my house, I'm paying the bills, I'm maintaining you, you're living in my house, you know, once you get your own place, you can live your own life, but as long as you're here, you can follow my rules, it's my house.
But the thing is, they don't move out and they stay and they don't want they want to.
Who is deciding that? No, you're deciding that. That's your choice. That's your choice. You're the one making that choice.
So exactly what is that, my choice?
Okay, your choice, you can say to them either, all right, you're living in my house, I'm maintaining you, and I'm willing to tolerate that you do what you want to do in my house because I'm not willing to have you leave. Or you can say, this is my house, I'm maintaining you, these are our rules, you either follow or you go. That's your choice. If your grown-up child is living with you and doing things that are very disturbing in your house, that's because you're letting them do that.
You're not letting them, but they...
Of course you're letting them. If you weren't letting them, they either would stop or leave. Of course you're letting them. How are you not letting them?
The thing is, we tell them they don't...
You tell them.
But they will still do it. What can you do? Okay,
just I'll try to say it again. The problem is you're not willing to have them leave. That's the problem. You're not willing to have them leave. So that's okay.
If they don't go, I can't tell them go, no?
No, you can say either you go or you follow our rules. Sure, you can say that. Or just don't maintain them then. But you've got to be willing to do that. So if you're not willing to do that, that's okay. You don't have to do that. But then admit that that's what I'm willing to do. It's my choice that I'm making. I am choosing to feed this child. I am choosing to pay their university bill. I am choosing to pay their car insurance while they live in my house and do things I don't like. And that's my choice that I'm making. Take responsibility for your choice. No, just be honest. You don't have to be strong one way or the other way. Just be honest. Imagine that it's not your child. Imagine it's an adult who's not related to you. What would you do? So suppose it was someone who wasn't your relative, and they're just an adult living in your house, and then doing those things. What would you do? What would you do? So we're making a choice. And it's a very good idea to be honest about the choices we're making. The reason it's good to be honest about the choices we're making is then we can deal with our children with integrity. Then I'll go to my child and say, listen, I am not willing to let you go on your own. I want to keep maintaining you. I'd rather you not do the things you're doing, but I'd rather tolerate what you're doing just so you're in my house and I'm taking care of you. And then I'll tell you, well, you won't bother you as much because you realize it's your choice, that you're making that choice. Does this make some more sense to you? Okay, does this make sense to everybody? Take ownership of your own choice. See, if you're not taking ownership of your own choice, you're going to try to keep forcing that grown-up child to come to a certain standard, and you're going to make it an even worse relationship with them. Make it honest. You have several choices. You can continue to maintain them, let them live in your house, and let them do nonsense. And that's when you're letting them do nonsense and be honest about it. Or you can say, if you want to do nonsense, you can't do it here. You can do it elsewhere. If they say, well, why should I go elsewhere? You're paying all my bills. Say, well, then we won't pay your bills here. But, that, you know, if you say that, you're taking the risk that they'll say, I'll move out and pay my own bills. Which might be a very good thing, by the way. That might not be a terrible thing. But if that's not the choice, each person has to decide what their choice is. What I choose to do with my rebellious 18-year-old, what you choose to do with your rebellious 18-year-old, and you choose to do with your rebellious 18-year-old, that's your personal choice. And that's, you can't make a rule. There's no rule in the Shastra. You know, you have to do this and this and this. But please say, understand, it is your choice. It is your choice. Yes.
My mother gave me that ultimatum when I was 15, and I moved out, and now I'm in the voluntary ashram.
No, it isn't. It may be a good thing. But you know, you have to be willing to do it. And for some people, they're not willing to do it. But my point is, if you're not willing to do it, that's also okay. That's also okay. If you want to maintain your kids till they get their master's degree, no matter what they're doing with their life, that's also okay. But just be open about it. Be open with yourself. If you're open with yourself, you're much less likely to be harassing your children. Because you're going to, whenever they do something you don't like, you'll remember, I am choosing to maintain my rebellious child because I want whatever it is you want. And each of us has different priorities that are important to us. So there isn't something formulaic. Because what works for me, what works for you, may not work for somebody else. Yes.
I also give an example for myself. My mother never stood up for things. She never actually told me that's how far you can go, and I just kind of cut off. And I really lost respect for my mother. I really lost it. And I did not at all, I wasn't at all quiet to my mother because I didn't respect her because she never stood up.
Yeah, I had the same situation happen when I was a teenager. Yeah, actually, children expect that their parents are going to draw a line. And when the parents don't, then the parents lose the ability. Also, see, if you're telling someone to do something, but there's no teeth behind it, you actually lose authority. So, either put teeth behind it or don't say it. Really, take your choice. Take your choice. Don't say it or put teeth behind it. It's okay not to say it. It's okay. That's okay to just tolerate it and not harass your children. But if you're going to harass them without teeth, then they won't respect you at all. And your ability to have any authority over them will be diminished. I mean, please don't do that at any time. Even with a 3-year-old. I mean, it's awful. Yeah, this is a whole other topic. But, you know, it's awful when you see parents say, if you do that one more time, you're going to have to stand in the corner. They do it one more time. If you do that one more time, you're going to have to stand in the corner. They do it one more time. If you do that one more time, you're going to have to stand in the corner. And after 20 times, then they, you know, just go, oh, you stupid kid! You know, so that's, children are not really very impressed with that kind of behavior. And you'll lose your authority. So either don't say it, or say it and mean it. Say what you mean and mean what you say. And if you're not willing to mean what you say and say what you mean, then just don't say it, and that's okay. You can decide what behavior you're just going to ignore. There's nothing wrong with that. But then be upfront. Say to your kid, look, you know, I'd rather have you live in my house even if you're smoking, drinking, and gambling. I'd rather have you live with my house than have you be out on your own when you're 16. So I'm making the choice to have you live in your house. I do think these things you're doing are wrong, but I'd rather live you live in the house than maintain. Be honest. That's all right. Honesty is good, but don't be, I mean, unless you want your children to lose respect for you, but, you know, if you want them to maintain some respect for you, be very, very clear. Very, very clear. Whether, if you say that you're going to do something, you say something's important, mean it and follow through. And if you're not willing to follow through, don't say it. Right? Okay? Yes. What do you think about homeschooling? What do I think about homeschooling? I think it's great. That's a really personal decision. How much you? I mean, some devotees do the whole homeschooling over the internet. They have a whole internet-based program. Like, that's really a personal decision. What works best for you? But, I mean, the homeschool kids that we're seeing from the devotee community are turning out really well, in general. I mean, obviously, there's always exceptions to everything. But in general, I'm seeing they're turning out really, really well materially and spiritually. And the homeschool kids out in the general world are also doing some of the best of all the children.
I mean, there's that homeschooling family in Boise, Idaho. They're now working with 20 or 30 other families. And practically all their kids are getting their master's degrees when they're 18 or 20. Plus, they're all nice devotees. Plus, they're all nice, civilized human beings. So that's... I think it's great. Yeah, I don't want to get too far into this. Unschooling works for some parents and some kids sometimes. And when it works great, but it's not something that most people should look at. But it's certain, I don't want to get there now, but you have to have some really special conditions for that to work well. That's certainly not something that people in general can do. I've seen it work great in a few cases, but in most cases it's disastrous. Yes?
As you say, if we cut off the connection of internet and TV and all that, aren't they actually arresting the right of the child to become a little child in it? Like, if they go out tomorrow, they might not be able to go.
Okay, very good point. So if they have no television, internet, they might not be a well-informed citizen. There's a very high-class school in London called St. James School, which they're kind of impersonalists. They teach Christianity and Mahayana philosophy and stuff, but they learn Sanskrit and they learn the Ramayana and Mahabharata. And they have a rule that until the children are 10, they're not allowed to touch computers. At home or at school, there's just no computers. And they also don't take children who are watching television. Now, at 10, they start giving them limited access to computers. So my suggestion is, if you want them to find out about the world, you give it in small doses under your supervision. You know, I do think it's a good idea, and this is my personal opinion, for children to watch some educational films on science, nature, history, like that. But you've got to keep it controlled. But those children are, like, they're some of the top educated kids in Britain. And their behavior, their etiquette, their behavior, oh, first class. I mean, academically they were first class, behavior-wise they were first class. So I haven't seen that kind of problem. I do think that it's dangerous to keep your kids 100% isolated from the world. I do think that's dangerous. We had some devotees who did that sort of thing like 30, 35 years ago. It's really not a good idea. Never take your kids to the shop. You know, I mean, that's, you know, the story of Rishyasringa. So that's really not a good idea. But you want their relation with the world to be controlled, and you want it to be such where they're learning skills of interacting with the world, not just that they're being subject to the bombardment of the world. Yes? How to inspire kids? Stories. Have a really tight, good personal relationship with them. And anything you do in the spiritual life, do your best to keep it emotionally positive. Avoid having any negative emotional experiences connected with spiritual activities. So do your best, those three things, and get rid of the material toys. get rid of the things that suck away inspiration. Okay, I'd like to end now unless somebody has something really, does anyone have something really intensely burning that got to ask? Yes.
They desire something and the parents don't give it, and they do not act as you require.
Okay, so I'm trying to understand. How old children are we talking about? 15. 14, 15? And they want something, like what kind of something? They want a new pair of roller skates? Or they want a separate bedroom. Okay, so the children 14, 15, they want a separate bedroom. So you can sit down with them and you say, okay, this is our financial situation. Treat them with some respect. This is our family situation. You would like a separate bedroom, and this is what our family needs are. And negotiate. So, you know, the only way I could give you a separate bedroom, I'd have to get a second job and a third job. You know, are there anything you could do to contribute to the family so we could build an extension onto the house?
I'd be happy to give you your own bedroom. I have no problem with giving you your own bedroom. But I really don't want to work an extra 4 hours a day. So what do you suggest we do about that? Does that make sense? You know, that's not, you're still not happy. Yeah, go ahead.
You
just want to live within the means what you have. No, you work with them and treat them as a person. And sit down. Okay, so you're really upset because you don't have your own bedroom, right? You really want your own bedroom, right? Yeah. Well, I think that would be nice. I'd like to give you your own bedroom, too. But the problem is that I've already got a mortgage on this house, already costing me $1,500 a month or whatever it is, $3,000 a month to pay for this house. And look, I'm bringing in, you know, whatever it is, $50,000 a year, and this is how much it's costing me, and I really don't have any, you know, you see the setup of the rooms here, so I'm not quite sure how we could do this for you. Do you have some suggestions? Because I don't mind doing this, but do you have some suggestions? How you'd like to do it? Ask them. Maybe they have some suggestions. Who knows? They might say, well, we could curtain off part of that room downstairs. Maybe you're willing to do that. Or maybe the reason you don't want to give their own bedroom is they don't take care of their room. And then you can say, okay, fine, if you want your own bedroom, then that's fine with me, but I see that the room you share with your brother, you're already not taking care of it, and your brother has to clean it up for you all the time, and your mother and I have to yell at you all the time to clean it up. So I'm worried that if I gave you your own bedroom, yeah, we've got that spare guest room there, we could give it to you as your bedroom, but I have two problems. First of all, where would I put guests? And second of all, would you keep it clean? And if we had a guest coming at the last minute, notice the room would be dirty. And then I really have a problem. So I want to have some kind of guarantee on my end that you're going to take care of that room such that if a guest comes, we're going to be able in 10 minutes to be able to put a guest in there. So what do you suggest that you could do? Negotiate with them. Treat them like a person. Treat them with some respect. Does that make sense? Is that okay?
But that is not the problem, and the problem is not at the money, but just to negotiate within that, how we can, don't want to build an extra room at the same time, want to please her also.
Then you sit and you negotiate. Negotiation means that that person expresses their needs, you express your needs, and you see if you can find a meeting ground where both of your needs are met. And you express what it is on your side. You know, I don't want to spend the money to build an extra bedroom because these are my concerns. Okay? Now you express your concerns. You've got to give the other person a chance. Now you express your concerns. And then you try to reach an agreement where both of your concerns are met. You know, that's... children, they will appreciate being dealt with respect. And you can do that even with seven-year-olds. You know, the seven-year-old says, I want more time to play. You say, it's time to come to dinner. You can say, I understand that you want to play. I understand that you want to play, that you have a need as a child for play, but I have a need to have dinner on time so I can wash the dishes on time, so I can get to bed on time, so I can get up in the morning. So I wonder how I can give you time to play and still be able to get to bed on time. Can we work out some solution? But people respond to this kind of thing. And people respond, don't you respond to that kind of thing? You know, do any of us respond very well to just do it because I said so? Who here likes that? Nobody likes that. So we respond to some respect. So if you're not sure how to do this, there's a number of good books. One of them is How to Talk So Kids Can Listen and How to Listen So Kids Can Talk. And that's a very, very good book. It has in there some ideas for negotiation skills and communication skills. Another really good book, which I don't agree with everything in there, but it's called Parent Effectiveness Training, PET. And that also talks a lot about good negotiation skills. So the more you have good negotiation skills, the more you have an atmosphere of mutual respect. And the more you show respect for your children, well, you know, they might also show some more respect for you. And you may find that you can reach mutual solutions that you're all happy with. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be my way or your way. It doesn't have to be that kind of a a situation. And you may find that your children, especially your older children, even your young children, may have many good ideas. It's not that I'm the only one who has good ideas. You know, 5-year-olds can have good ideas too. And they're really happy if you listen to them and you ask them their opinion on things. The more that you do that kind of thing, the more that they'll want to listen to you, the more they'll feel part of the family, the more they'll feel part of the society, and the more that they'll be inclined, we're talking about a real relationship of trust, the more they'll be inclined to do what you want because you're also showing respect for them. So if this sounds really foreign to those of you who grew up in a very domineering authoritarian culture, I'm going to repeat the same thing. That domineering authoritarian culture is not going to work in the modern world. It just isn't. It doesn't matter arguing whether it's good or bad or it ought to work. It just isn't going to work. Children have too many contrary examples. Even if you say that's the way it should be. So you can argue till the cows come home, as we say, that that's the way it should be. And it still isn't going to work anymore. Not now. You know, maybe in 200 years if we're back to a simple agrarian culture and there's no more television and internet, then maybe that'll work again. But right now, that just simply isn't going to work. All right, so we had some nights. We talked about the reasons for having sadhana. We talked about the benefits of sadhana at home, the benefits of sadhana at a temple. We talked about a lot of ideas for how to do sadhana at home, a lot of ideas for how to do sadhana at a temple. And then we talked about the 6 ways to stay inspired, which were? College and ups and downs. Thank you very, very much. It's a wonderful group. And it's so nice to see so many children. All glory to Srila Prabhupada.
All glory to Srila Prabhupada.